Welcome to the Zikri Simkins Podcast, Episode 15, Ross Martin. This is David Simkins, and this podcast is a true blast from the past. Boomers will be familiar with Ross Martin as the actor who, in the late 1960s, played Artemus Gordon on TV's The Wild Wild West. But before that, among the many episodes of television he worked in, Ross did a couple of turns for Rod Serling on The Twilight Zone. In 1978, Mark Zikri was 22 years old and just beginning the research that would lead him to write the book on Serling's masterpiece, The Twilight Zone Companion. You can find it at Amazon. This interview Mark conducted with Ross Martin 30 years ago takes you backstage into the world of the working actor, circa 1961, when the Twilight Zone episodes were filmed, and into the mind of Rod Serling, the man who did more to define the world of television science fiction than anyone before or since. When Mark chooses to let more of these gems emerge from his personal collection, we'll bring them to you. Ross discusses acting in several episodes of The Twilight Zone, as well as his work in the thriller Experiment in Terror and the science fiction classic The Conquest of Space.
Well, we can perhaps it'd be best to start with The Four of Us Are Dying, the first Twilight Zone you were in.
Oops. Yes, it's okay. What would you like to know about it?
Well, I found an article, which was an interview with Mildred Gussie, who was the casting director at
yes,
that time.
Yes, yes.
And how were you cast for that?
Well, I don't truly recall. Mm-hmm. I think it was Millie who was instrumental in getting me into it.
Mm-hmm.
She had great faith in me and had seen my work earlier somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And she was confronted with a problem, an additional problem in the casting. There were four people who had to bear some slight resemblance mm-hmm. to one another, Mr. Zachary. There had to be, even despite the extension of Twilight Zone, the constant stretching of imagination required for it, the constant yielding of your thresholds of disbelief in order to go with it, it had to have its roots
mm-hmm.
at least touching in the areas of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So she needed four people who were inherently somewhat similar, not in terms of quality, but in terms of general appearance. They all had to be somewhere near the same height.
Mm-hmm.
They all had to be, if you're going to go blonde, they all had to be blonde. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go red-haired, they all had to be red-haired. We went brunette, I think, because the problems were mm-hmm. less, and all of us were brunette, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Philip is brunette at that time. He's, I think, grayer today. We're all getting longer in the tooth.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Towns, myself,
mm-hmm.
and what's his name?
Don Gordon.
Mm-hmm. Good actor. In fact, indeed, they were all good actors. That was the one thing that I think marked that series.
Mm-hmm.
They were meticulous about getting gifted people to
mm-hmm.
work in it. And it was a pleasure to do, that's all. It was just a pleasure to do.
Mm-hmm.
I had a scene with Beverly Garland.
Yes, I have. Let's see.
I believe that scene, right? Oh, good Lord, you've even got the pictures. Oh, I was never that young.
And then here's
how did you find this? Yes. Now, see, that was the composite of
mm-hmm.
remarkable kind of
thing. Yes. That's good. And then here's the another composite photo.
Yes. You can see that it has elements of
mm-hmm.
a certain similarity, and step by step could be made
mm-hmm.
to go from one face to the other,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene with Bev was
mm-hmm.
6 minutes long, of approximately 7.5 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the motion picture technique, it's pieces and patched together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was directed by John Brahm. And I'm amazed that I remember it, but
mm-hmm.
I do remember the incident particularly.
Mm-hmm.
I think he may have had a little something to do with this too.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you why after this particular story, but we had a rehearsal and then a second rehearsal, and it felt pretty good. They said, well, shall we try and let's see how far we go? And they slapped a full magazine into the camera, full magazine of film, mm-hmm. so that there would be no need to stop because we'd run out of film. Mm-hmm. And we did the scenes, and it ran the full 6 minutes. And it was one of those rare things where there were no technical problems, there was no bobble in the words, and the scene was full, and we were fine. Mm-hmm. He said, print, that's marvelous, it's take one, it's and print. Mm-hmm. And he then went in for a closer shot, because that was the master. Mm-hmm. And set the camera up so that he'd photograph Beverly, and we did it a second time. Mm-hmm. And it was a print on take two. Mm-hmm. And we did it a third time, it was a print on take three. Now, he had anticipated that the filming would take well into the afternoon mm-hmm. of this particular scene. Figured to give approximately two-thirds of a day to it. Mm-hmm. And here it was 10:30 in the morning and he was finished. So we really had fun. He began mm-hmm. to noodle. He started pointing the camera lens up our nostrils, you know, and all kinds of interesting things that he tried to get with it. But it was startling that in three takes he had his master, his over-the-shoulder on one and his over-the-shoulder on the other, and usually for television it's more than enough. Mm-hmm. So that we were fortunate in that that scene had a certain amount of additional color mm-hmm. and colors, so to speak, that came out of, and textures, mm-hmm. that came out of the ability to keep changing the angles and finding little moments to close in even mm-hmm. closer. And that's not possible unless you have an actress mm-hmm. who is trained in theater and knows, you know, can sustain mm-hmm. a scene. And she's, Beverly has always been wonderful. I worked with her years later and mm-hmm. I, on a regular basis in Stump the Stars game show, mm-hmm. as you know. And that,
yes, my wife used to watch that.
She was such fun. She used to regularly pound me in the nose in order to get me silent. Or to get me to say a word. It was just, I adore her. She's a great friend.
When was Stump the Stars on? I don't remember ever seeing it.
It was on after Mr. Lucky. Mm-hmm. It began approximately a year and a half, maybe, or about a year to a year and a half. Now, after Mr. Lucky had gone off the air.
Now, when was Mr. Lucky on?
That was on from in the season of 59 and 60.
Uh-huh. So your Twilight Zone role was
just prior to that?
No, it was after.
Was it after?
Yeah.
Then it had to be immediately after.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It had to be immediately after.
Now, did you work with Harry Townsend and Philip Pine and Don Gordon to achieve a similar movement, or was any of that?
Yes, we discussed, as I remember, we discussed mm-hmm. some of the elements that would go into what Harry Town, if I remember, was the central figure mm-hmm. who had to change into the others. And we discussed how to move from whatever his entering move was going into a given scene mm-hmm. to how we would carry it from that into whatever our character was supposed to be mm-hmm. so that certain, not behavioral, not content materials, but behavioral materials mm-hmm. could be carried for a transition from one character into another. It was an additional challenge and a lot of fun. And I must say, Rod Serling came down on the set personally mm-hmm. and visited with us. He was intrigued by this particular one and, mm-hmm. and chatted with us about it and asked, you know, about procedures and how mm-hmm. we were going about it. And he was very pleased at the kind of seriousness with which all four of us were mm-hmm. approaching our roles. Mm-hmm. I started to say John Brom. Mm-hmm. John Brom, mm-hmm. I think he indicated to me that he had immediately said yes when my name came up. Mm-hmm. Because I came out to the West Coast in 1958 from New York. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I was out here 2 weeks when I got called, cast and called to go back to New York and star in an episode of, what was that series they used to do there? It's terrible to be up on titles like this. Naked City. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, Harry, John Brahm was the director. And we had never worked together. And it was a beautiful story. It was written by Sterling Siliphant, who was, you know, he and Rod were at one time the two outstanding writers in television. And it was a story of a immigrant man who had come here with his family and usually played 10 cents on the numbers, hoping to hit each day. And on the one day, he found a $10 bill and he bet the $10 bill and, and he hit it. And of course, the person he had bet it with simply absconded the money. It was too big a temptation, he couldn't stay. And his world kind of collapsed. But there were some very touching moments and we worked under very difficult conditions. And I remember that John, who had never known my work up until that point, was most complimentary. And then when, you know, my memory isn't that strong, when I came to work on The Four of Us Are Dying, I think he said something about, I'm glad I wanted you for this. But certainly Millie, who was an ardent fan and a most gracious woman, she's a lovely lady. You know, to this day, she's casting.
Do you know where she is now? Because I've been trying to look.
Yes, she is at Paramount Studios.
Paramount Studios? Okay. Because she was with
Hunter.
Recently, but then they didn't know where she was after
I
that.
Think she's at Paramount Studios. She has an office, or at least she did, as of 2 years ago.
Well, I'll give
at Paramount Studios.
Okay. I'll give him a try at
least. Yes.
But how is John Brahm to work with as a director?
He's
I interviewed him, by the way.
He's very good. He's very brusque on occasion. I found him very good to work with. I found that he knew what he was looking for in a scene, basically. This is not, we're just rambling, you and I. This is not about The Four of Us Are Dying, but it is about that 10-cent dream thing that I did in New York. There was one scene after he had hit in which he was a Puerto Rican, and he is going down to collect his money. And he's being serenaded by all of his neighbors. They've got guitars and they're going down with him. Everyone's going down to collect this big sum of money that he's hit in New York. He's going to give a block party, you know. There's a whole, his dream has come true. And I had played him extremely purely, a very simple kind of naive man, a man from a small town on Puerto Rico, which is a little island to begin with, you know, and a man who had really almost apologetic in his approach to life, a very simple, pure, loving, naive kind of person. And in this scene, as they're walking down the street, and he's got one of these little kind of weasels, a little, a muska, you know, going alongside him to his Falpone, saying things like, what you got to do with money is to take the money, you do this with it. He's got buzzing around him. And I played him with the kind of self-righteous attempt at big business importance. He was carrying a cigar. And I played him as though weighing it, as though he were a business titan. Now, what started me with that was remembering my own dear dead father, who had such purity and was so beautiful. He had such simplicity about him. And
he was a tinsmith, right?
He was a tinsmith and roofer. And he had worked as a tinsmith since he was a 10-year-old boy. He was apprenticed at that age. And he died at 59. You're looking at 49 years of effort in the one area. But toward the latter part of his life, when he was 52, he went into business with somebody else. And it was the first time he had ever done it. He was going to be his own boss. And after the thing was finished and he came home, he had a cigar. He had a 10-cent cigar. He never smoked cigars. He had bought a 10-cent cigar. And that whole air of having done something of gigantic, titanic, mogul importance, real big business, mm-hmm. you know, was about him. And I tried to catch that in this scene. It would have been not only touching and human, but terribly funny, and have a humor and pathos at both at the same time, because the moment he gets to the candy store to go in and collect, all of this facade crumbles, and he puts his hand on the door to go in, and it crumbles. He turns around, and the Muska says to him, "Well, go in, get the money." And he says, "I can't. It's too much money. It's too much money." Now that's terribly funny if a guy has been quasi pompous, and suddenly it all falls away from him. John, the moment I started to play the self-righteous air while walking down the street, screams from behind the camera, "No," he yelled, "what are you doing? That's terrible! That's terrible!" He ran up to me. "Yesterday," he said, "you were so simple, so pure." He shouted in my nose, "That's terrible! What are you doing?" I said, "Mr. Brahm, it's not terrible at all. You may not want it, and if you don't, I'll do something else, if you're that opposed to it. But," I said, "there's something very touching in his effort to be important. If it collapses as it does when he goes to open the door at the end of this scene, at the end of the beat." And I said, "and then once he does compel himself to go in, the tragedy that's behind the door, which is that the man is no longer there, he is, there's nobody there, it's gone, and the whole dream is shattered." I said, "there's so much more to come down from if you see this simple man trying to create a giant world for himself." He says, "No, that's terrible. That's terrible." I said, okay. "I'll do something else." I said, "Terrible it's not. We have different opinions with regard to this." But it was a lesson for me in learning, you know, that you, in film, it really doesn't pay ever to fight a quarrel with somebody. I did years later in other things where I felt it was far more important. I could continue to play the beat in that simple, quiet style. It would have had, it just has a moment where there's less color in it, I think. He couldn't see it at all. He didn't. I don't think he knew where I felt it was coming from or where I was taking it to. And I really had seen it happen with a very simple and pure man, with my father. And in much the same way, it was terribly touching and very dear. And so that was one of the things. But he's very good. He's technically, he's extremely good. And he's very gentle with actors, usually. He's just brusque in manner, that's all. But he'll say, "we can do a little better with this, don't you think?" And I'd say, "Yes." And I'd say, "let's try. We try it again. Never mind. We've got that in case we need it. But let's try it again."
In Four of Us Are Dying, there was one shot where you have Harry Towns shaving in a mirror.
Yes.
And he lights a cigarette. The camera follows his hand down the ashtray. Yes. Well, no, it pans over to the mirror.
Yes.
And you see either you or Philip Pine. And then the hand takes the cigarette down to an ashtray. Camera follows it down to the ashtray. Comes back up, and it's someone else in the mirror.
Yes.
How was that done?
Well, they remember that the hand of the actor that's followed by the camera is followed down to the ashtray, and that's close enough so that all you see is the hand in the ashtray. They have racked focus, in other words, from the mirror image, which has to be the distance of the actor to the image, to the mirror, plus the distance of the mirror to the lens. So you rack focus, which means, you know, you take the focus down so it can be as close as the ashtray and cigarette, which might be 3 feet, the other distance is 8 feet. As the actor brings his hand down to the ashtray, as, say, I or Harry, whoever it was, brings the hand down to the ashtray, you flip it and step out of the box, out of the X, the marks, where, which had been made for you to step into. and then bring it back mm-hmm. and place it into the mouth of the man who has stepped into that mouth. And that was Phil Pine.
Mm-hmm.
So that it looks like he's, you know, when he's put it down here, he brings it back, and there's another face there. It's a mm-hmm. different man.
Was it a real mirror, or was there, was it a, you know, another, you know, just a glass with some...
Was the cigarette brought back?
No, was it a real mirror, or was...
I'm asking whether the cigarette was brought back and put in the mouth.
It was brought back to the mouth, yes.
Then it was an image.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Hmm.
There's no other way to do that.
Hmm. It was a very smooth transition. It was very nicely done.
Yes. Well, that's carefully thought through. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to create those effects, and mm-hmm. one must sit and actually figure what the effects are going to be in order to make them work.
Mm-hmm. Did you do... My wife is telling me all about all these wonderful roles she's seen you in, and she and her boss were trying to remember the name of Experiment in Terror.
Yes.
For one, which I haven't seen, but they've been raving and raving and raving.
Well, thank you. That I was nominated for Best Supporting Actor mm-hmm. in that. Indeed, I've seen that several times. It was just unfortunate. At the time it was released, there were some internal changes going on at Columbia Pictures, which, you know, resulted in some difficulties mm-hmm. with the manner in which it was released,
mm-hmm.
so that it didn't get the kind of play that it was promised.
Mm-hmm.
But I got great reviews for it, I must say, and I couldn't believe them. I didn't believe that I had gotten to that point in my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I made no effort to mount a campaign to get myself, mm-hmm. you know, either the Oscar or anything else. It was just, I handled it rather poorly, I think.
Really?
Well, to admit. Well, that's a career matter. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't have to do with acting at all. Because it was, all of the reviews,
mm-hmm.
all of the reviewers at the end of the year, mm-hmm. when they said, when time comes to consider, you know, in the best support division,
mm-hmm.
You're limited in the number of people that you can possibly choose this year, because there weren't that many that were really outstanding. Certainly, you would have to consider Ross Martin in Experiment in Terror, Ed Begley.
Mm-hmm.
For the Tennessee Williams thing he did, Victor Buono for the picture he had done with Betty Davis.
Mm-hmm.
But my name was always either first or second in that list.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, I was with an agency at the time. I guess pretty sure that, mm-hmm. you know, they'd get it. But what they didn't count on was mm-hmm. that Columbia Pictures had a lot of eggs in Lawrence of Arabia.
Hmm.
And had another actor under option whom they wanted to build
mm-hmm.
quite big. He'd been a star in Egypt. It was Omar Sharif.
Mm-hmm.
And my name was left off of the list submitted to the to the Academy,
mm-hmm.
which was started.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say it's deliberate at all. It mm-hmm. was because I had end billing, mm-hmm. and the result was that it just didn't appear. It mm-hmm. does not appear.
Mm-hmm.
If you see the list of pictures eligible
mm-hmm.
for that year,
mm-hmm.
and turn to Experiment in Terror,
mm-hmm.
you will not find my name on it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dear.
Some of the breaks, I laugh about it, but it's very disappointing.
Yes.
I was nominated for a Globe Award by the Foreign Press Association for mm-hmm. my performance in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in Spain again at the time, and, mm-hmm. and even there, there was no picture of me receiving it until after the awards were over. I came back from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
I made a picture there with Lawrence Harvey
mm-hmm.
Called The Ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Lawrence Harvey and Sarah Miles, she was then a young, very gifted actress,
mm-hmm.
and Robert Walker Jr.
Now, Death Ship was done in 62.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, how were you cast for that one, do you recall?
No, I do not.
Mm-hmm. Now,
you don't know who was listed as casting director then. Was it still Millie?
No, it was John Conwell.
Oh, yes, I do recall how I was cast in that.
Mm-hmm.
The director cast me.
Don Medford.
Don Medford.
Mm-hmm.
Don knew me from New York, and knew my work,
mm-hmm.
and had worked with me in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And wanted to work with me again, and I was I think he's excellent. Mm-hmm. I just think he's a super director. I wanted to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
If Gunn has any fault, he's such a fan of my work that even when I'm bad, he thinks it's good. But it's just personal fondness, you know. Uh-huh. I don't mean to make that sound like he has no discriminatory taste. He has super discriminatory taste. But he's just such a fan that he almost can't see me objectively anymore. And I adore his work. I just think he's one of the most exciting directors I've ever worked with. And he likes strong actors who make statements. He liked Jack Klugman for that reason, too. I think he pretty much asked for the people that were involved, and certainly in the three leads.
You know. So, how did you prepare for that? Well, I mean, you did a terrific job in it, if you recall.
I honestly don't recall what preparation I had for it. It was, I felt very close to it. It dealt with a man's relationship to his family, his wife and his daughter. I was separated at that time from my own daughter, who was living with my wife in New York. My first wife. And so that there were elements of my own longing that went into the relationship with the young girl, with that little child that I worked with. Moreover, I don't recall her name. It was a name like McNamara or something like that.
Maggie McNamara?
Yeah, no. That's a young model at that time. No, this was a little, she was then 10 years old. But I had worked with her 2 years earlier, or three years earlier, in Mr. Lucky. She played a role kind of like Little Miss Market. And we'd fallen in love with one another. She was, at that time, 8 or 7 and a half. And I adored her. She was so cute. She was so, I don't know, I've heard stories about, you know, spare me child actors and things of that kind. I get along with them famously. I just adore them. They're great to work with. And we had all of that going for us, all of the affection and the fondness from the first appearance and on the Mr. Lucky thing, going for us now. It was a pleasure to see her so grown up and so. And so it was very easy. I had a lot of my own emotion that I could transfer into the role. And all I had to do was think of the distance between my own daughter and myself, the 3,000 miles. She was in New York and the East Coast, and I was out here in the West Coast. And think of how badly I wanted to see her, and the scenes became effortless to play.
Now, how did you prepare immediately before the take? Did you go off by yourself, or how did you? Because
well, which is there any particular scene?
Well, the scene where you wake up on the bank of the little lake, and you see, and then your daughter runs out and says, "I found you, I found you," and then, you know.
I had found that certain personal things with regard to my own daughter motivate me or drive me or move me. Years ago in a class with Marty Ritt, who is now a brilliant, huge director, I studied with Marty Ritt. And one of the exercises we had was to move a distance of something like, had to be 18 feet or something, in three steps, and sit in a chair. I mean, just move three steps and you're sitting in a chair. And I said, it can't be done. And he said, you give yourself something that will make you do that. Think something that will make you do that. Picture something that will make you do that. Marty is fantastic at his ability to physicalize materials. He was a fine actor. By the way, I don't know whether you ever saw The Paper Box Kid, but it was a giant performance he did on television. Back in those golden days, you weren't even born, why am I asking? But it was the golden days of live TV, and it was on one of the half-hour shows. He did a film called, it was a live performance called The Paper Box Kid, which was one of the most beautifully physicalized performances I had ever seen in my life. And Marty was heavy then, just as he is now. But I had, in the exercise, in connection with that exercise, I had pictured my daughter under certain circumstances. Now, it's a horrible thing to even mention. But the truth is that if the actors always use tools like this,
mm-hmm.
I pictured a burning building,
mm-hmm.
and I pictured her at the window inside a burning building,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and calling to me in near panic, "Daddy, Daddy."
Mm-hmm.
And I took those, I took the 50, I almost bowled the chair over at the end of the three steps, that it was effortless to stride the length of a man's body. You're shot almost as though out of a cannon. But that's because that is meaningful to me and would move me. And I used similar circumstances involving my own daughter in my mind. In preparation for the scene. So that when I turned and saw her, my heart just broke. I just, the joy at seeing.
It was terrific.
Well, I don't remember. You know, you say it's terrific, it's very kind of you, but I don't recall. After you've done so many hundreds upon hundreds of television shows, the details of individual ones tend to get a little fuzzy, particularly with regard to specific elements of the performance. And perhaps I should have gone with you to see the thing in order to remember.
Well, if you want to see it, let's say.
Well, it, as a matter of seeing the old thing, it would have been great fun, but I was under real pressure this week. I've just returned from New York. And I have, had 5 weeks in a play in I Do. So that material is accumulated on my desk up there. It's just the mountains of it. I've got to get out from under that. I didn't have time to go see it before our meeting. But you know, some of these might, my memory might be refreshed. But I do remember the kind of modern nature of their costumes. This is projected into the future, and a kind of idyllic atmosphere in which they were living.
Well, it was a picnic.
Heaven.
Kind
yeah.
Of yes. Was that shot on the MGM back lot?
Yes, it was.
Yes, I thought so. And then the way that scene works is, the child comes out, and then you tell her to stay there, and you run through the brush until you find.
Yes.
The wife. Right by the picnic bench, and it's a really wonderful scene. You're going through all the brush, and it's a long scene, you know, trying to get to her, and it builds and it builds, and then you find her. And then, of course, Jack Klugman comes out of the brush and
tries to pull me back.
Yes.
What it is the, he's infusing me with the will to live, in actual fact, because it turns out they were dead.
Yes.
Now, there are a great many theories with regard to that, which I didn't know at that time, with regard to your being helped over the bar, so to speak, between life and death by those who have gone on before, whose souls have known yours. And I don't know how much of that occurs in our own minds, and how much of that no one has ever returned to be able to give us any actual data. My inclination is to believe that it's our minds that take us back as death draws close. And certainly it makes for a very interesting dramatic moment and a dramatic concept. But it was his love for them that was enough to make him willing to give up his life in order to be with them in the afterlife. And he's drawn back by Klugman. And you feel, God, he's been pulled back to life. But you realize that, like a broken record that just keeps slipping the groove and going back to replay the same brief thing again and again and again, these three are doomed to go through all eternity like the Flying Dutchman, just lost. Lost and coming through space and reliving these same moments fresh without realization until at the moment they realize it, the needle slips on the phonograph record and you're back in the beginning groove again. Frightening, isn't it?
Yes, it was wonderful. Now, when Klugman falls
back, think of how creative that is for Rod Serling to have conceived.
Well, it was Richard Matheson. That one was written by Richard.
That one was his?
Yeah.
Whoever the author was. It just,
yes,
what an idea. What an idea. It's just lovely.
I saw that when I was 8 years old and I remembered it.
Really?
All until I saw it just this past year again. But I remembered all the details of the plot. And
yeah. Movie.
And I remember the picnic grounds and all of that. Yes.
Well, how nice that is to hear.
Yes.
You know, there's a continuum in our craft and in our business and in our lives. When I was 7 years of age, mm-hmm. I saw a film called Potemkin,
mm-hmm.
made by Sergei Eisenstein.
Yes.
And I saw it again when I was 32 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot describe how many scenes I had total recall of, because the film had etched itself so deeply into my consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear that you saw it at 8,
mm-hmm.
well, you're well under 32 still, but to have carried it for that period of time is 12 years or thereabouts,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yes. More than that?
More than 12. Well, it's nice to know that some things that we do without really... We do them because we love the craft, and we do them because we hope to entertain for the moment, and on occasion even to edify,
mm-hmm.
but mostly to entertain. And that we don't realize that we've left impressions on... I must say it because that's the nature of television, millions of people.
Yes.
And several hundred thousand of whom are going to recall,
mm-hmm.
or at least have... you know, fond remembrance of mm-hmm. specific moments in it.
Yes.
That's nice. That's nice to know.
Yes.
That's nice to know.
Now, when Jack Klugman pulls you back,
yes.
you wander around the interior of the spaceship calling out the name Ruth.
Yes.
In growing amounts of, well, not hysteria, but, you know, loss.
Anguish, yes.
Now, how did you work up to that?
I believed the circumstance.
Because it's really... Everyone in it is good, but your performance really stands out as...
Well, that's very dear of you to say. It's nice to know I have a fan. I hope someday you produce the same way.
Yes.
I don't know. I find that if I can believe the circumstance...
Mm-hmm.
If I can believe the circumstance, it becomes an easier matter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've certainly had people who have died
mm-hmm.
in my family. My grandmother died when I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered my sense of loss, which was so strong that at first I blocked it off.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that I didn't accept the fact that she was dead, but because I hadn't seen her die,
mm-hmm.
and I hadn't seen her after she had died.
Mm-hmm.
I arrived after the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
I had a long distance to travel. And in another state, I wasn't even aware of it, exactly, until it was too late.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Jewish faith, you have to be buried within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was no getting back in time. But when it finally did dawn on me, I remember the sense of loss, and I had an exercise that I'd once done also in Martin Ritt's class, where you had to sing,
mm-hmm.
are you all right for taste?
Yes, I'm just making certain because I certainly want someone.
You had to sing a song
mm-hmm.
that was counterpoint to what's going on inside the scene, in other words, it can't be a song. If you're feeling joyous, it can't be a joyous song.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose a song that was very meaningful to my wife and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I played a scene in which she had just... I'd come back from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And she had been in an automobile accident in my mind and had been hurt. and I had to play the same singing, this meaningful light kind of breezy number, mm-hmm. while letting the death sink into my consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I brought into the class some of her actual dresses, mm-hmm. so that they could be used to trigger me off. Mm-hmm. I had none of that here, mm-hmm. in doing the episode on, you know, on the, mm-hmm. death ship. Mm-hmm. Nor could I even go back and use the other as a memory. Mm-hmm. But because I had explored that area, mm-hmm. at one time, I knew what kind of effect it would have on me. Mm-hmm. And all I had to do was think what the loss of someone I loved that much, that I had come so far to find, mm-hmm. had clawed my way through underbrush to get to, mm-hmm. and had been pulled back, mm-hmm. and forced, mm-hmm. not to go, and then the growing awareness that she's dead and that I will never see her, mm-hmm. is, if you believe the circumstances, suddenly the rest becomes fairly easy. Mm-hmm. I tend not to intellectualize what I do too much. I can give you good reasons afterwards, mm-hmm. but I let my viscera take over. And I think that that comes, if you have empathy for human beings and what they go through, mm-hmm. empathy for their fun, empathy for their tragedy, empathy for their love and their feelings and their hopes and shattered dreams and everything else. Mm-hmm. If you can put yourself in someone else's shoes and understand, mm-hmm. what they're going through, then you can write what they're going through. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't trust your capacity to sit down and do it with such careful, slow, procedural, intellectual, mm-hmm. Activity, you can act what they're going through. Mm-hmm. And for me, I find that acting what they go through is fairly easy. Mm-hmm. I had an association. I was 2.5 years old and I saw a beggar on the street. Mm-hmm. And I broke into tears, and my mother started trying to find out what it was that was bothering me. Mm-hmm. And she hunted around for safety pins, for what it could be, you know, that, mm-hmm. would just make me cry. So, and when, and I was ashamed to tell her because I thought it was wrong. Mm-hmm. And when she finally said, "What is it?" And I said, "That man, that poor man, is so cold and looking in there, and he has no money." She repeated the story to me years later, which is the only reason I remember. I don't remember the incident. Mm-hmm. But obviously, something, mm-hmm. and I don't know where that comes from, an echoing chord was struck in me. I could feel that man's plight. I knew what he was going through, even as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I was disturbed by it. Mm-hmm. You have really done some research and found, oh, Lord.
Although you've never seen that?
No, I never have. As a matter of fact, I have never seen any of the photographs you have. Mm-hmm. I have never seen, mm-hmm. any of the ones you have. On The Four of Us Are Dying, the only one I saw was the single of me going, mm-hmm. Down from that door. Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I took that off a movie on the screen from Charles.
Oh, you did it yourself?
Yes.
Fabulous.
Yes. And that's, of course, you looking at yourself.
Yes.
Dead. And, now that had to be done.
Split screen.
Right.
They filmed the one thing first. Mm-hmm. This is relatively easy because, you know, when you're dead, you're immobile. So, mm-hmm. all they need is basically is for you to stay there. Mm-hmm. But the problem is in filming the other half, mm-hmm. after this is blacked off. Mm-hmm. Inside, you can almost see where it occurs.
Yes.
The problem is in relating from this side when you have to move and pinpointing where the head is and where what you would relate to. Mm-hmm. what you would find hard to believe in terms of your own ongoing life. Mm-hmm. But it's startling to see. It's like seeing an identical twin or clone or something. Oh, yes. That you sent me. I remember this. Thank you. That was that picture in the Interplanetary Administration.
Yes. And then the...
Fabulous material.
I don't know if you can see these, but... Yeah. These are the proofs of the Shastotic. There you are looking. This is the line where you say, may God have mercy on our souls.
Oh, yes. Knowing that they're going on forever.
I played the tape of that last line in preparation for this, and my wife said, in the hands of a lesser actor, that line would have been terrible. But because you're so good, you're able to carry off lines like that, which can come across very melodramatically if they're mishandled.
Oh, well, you've got to mean them from your roots. Mm-hmm. You've got to mean them from the roots on up.
And then here, this is you looking over the scanner,
screen. Yes, at the beginning thing again. It starts all over again.
This is the, with you and Jack hugging you.
Oh, yes, stretched on these, they still use those reclining chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Most of this was, the technical advice on this was usually very sound.
Mm-hmm.
I had done a picture when I first came out to Hollywood called
Conquest of Space.
The Conquest of Space.
Mm-hmm.
And Werner
Von Braun
was the technical advisor on that. And all of it was really authentically authenticated. It was all extremely sound scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. I had forgotten this. Mm-hmm. It's like seeing it again for the first time. You know, I think I might enjoy seeing this.
Well, you really
I'd love to take my bride and come see it.
Let's do that. Okay, whenever it's convenient for you.
I'll give you a call, then.
That'd be great.
Well, Mark, not Bill Zach, because I know Bill Zach.
Oh, Mark. That would be wonderful.
Give me your number here.